she wanted to say. You should not have to earn him. Instead, she held her tongue and tried to hum away the worry in her heart. What harm can a little hope do? Ula told herself. But hope rises like water trapped by a dam, higher and higher, in increments that mean nothing, until you face the flood. They reached the surface before dawn, when the sky was still dark. Ula had been above before, when she'd first learned storm magic, bobbing in the waves, the stars sparkling in the black sky above her like another great sea, the hulking shape of the coast lying like a monster's tail across the horizon. She had stayed to watch the sun turn the water pink and gold, gilding the castle on the high cliffs, and then sought shelter below. But now Ula and the others let the tide take them inland to a small cove, a grim slash of gray sand and black rock. They were greeted on the shore by the Hedjut, the fishermen of the north, with whom the Sildroher kept an easy alliance. The sea folk held storms at bay for Hedjut boats, kept their nets full of mussels and crab, and drove whales into their waters. In return, the fishermen kept Sildroher's secrets, provided them with horses, and fetched the trunks of human clothes ordered by noble Sildroher families. It was from the Hedjut that the sea folk had learned human language and custom, and it was before these silent fishermen that they now thrashed in the waves. There is no pain like the pain of transformation. A mermaid does not simply shed her skin and find a mortal body beneath. To walk on land is to have your body cleft in two, split into something other. On that beach, Ula, Signy, Roth, and the rest of the party drew the sacred sickern blades, hewn from narwhal tusk and heavy with enchantments. They raised the song of transformation and plunged the knives into their own bodies. Many of the royal sons and nobles had been aided by court singers in the making of their knives, but not Ula, who had crooned the notes that would bind power to her blade with infinite care. Still, no matter how well crafted the knife, the song was the greater challenge. It was the deepest magic, music of rending and healing, the only song all royalty were trained in from birth. It was not complicated, but required great will, and Ula worried that Signy would not have the strength for it. But with eyes locked on Roth, Signy raised her voice and made the cut. Only then did Ula add her own voice to the song and drive her blade into her tail. The terror was worse than the pain. The surety that something had gone wrong and that she would be torn apart from head to fin. Blood spilled around her in torrents, staining the sea foam pink before the tide brought another wave of salt to clean her wounds. And still she sang on, holding the notes steady, knowing that if she did not, she would never heal completely, but simply lie there, bleeding, a mess of scales and half-formed limbs. The pain eased. The last notes were sung. Ula marveled at the strange curve of her hips, the dark thatch of hair between her legs, the odd, awkward knobs of her knees. And feet? Sad little flippers with their crenellated toes. She could hardly believe such things would support her, let alone propel her forward. The Hedjut fishermen averted their eyes and hauled the Sildroher from the sand, over the rocks, their new legs wriggling limply. The men were gentle enough, but still Ula felt panic clawing at her heart. It was too strange. The fresh light of dawn all around her, the still solidity of the land, the air coursing raw through her lungs. She struggled to find calm, afraid she would embarrass herself. In the fishermen's shacks, Ula and the others Sildroher dressed themselves and shod their vulnerable and untried feet in shoes made special for the trip, cushioned with lamb's wool and spells. They spent the better part of the day learning to walk, wobbling and laughing as they stumbled, grasped, felt the earth beneath them. Some had experience from summers past, but even for those who had never come to land, it was not so hard as it might be for a human child. They were a graceful people, strong from years keeping steady against the tides. Through all of it, the Sildroher took great care with their knives. New cuts would be required in 3 months' time, more blood magic to bind their legs and form their tails so they might go home again. The blades could touch nothing of the mortal world before then, or they would lose the power to return the sea folk to their true forms. So the Sodroher wrapped the sicker knives in the skin and scales they had shed, and stored them safely in their trunks. Ulla saw that Signy and Rolf were looking at her strangely, but there was little time to think on it, for the coaches had arrived, wrought in silver and gold, their doors bright with lacquer and emblazoned with the symbol of the Sildroher royal family. Though that emblem would mean nothing to the men of the shore. The horses, vast beasts of dappled gray with black eyes like seals, stamped their massive hooves. As Signy and Ulla gasped, and Rolf doubled over with laughter, none of these wonders were new to him. Soon they were thundering down the great road that ran along the edge of the coast, to the city of Sondermann. They had all seen the city from afar, perched on the tip of the white cliffs they called the Severed Moon. The towers of the church where the great iron bells, enchanted by Sildroher magic, were said to compel even the worst sinners to prayer. But Ulla could barely think for all the sensations racing through her. The seat beneath her newly formed thighs, the brush of her skirts against her legs, the jouncing of the carriage. With every jolt, the Sildroher whooped or clutched their sides, wild with the strangeness of it all. Through the chaos and commerce of the lower town, they rattled, over punishing cobblestones, then past the gates to the great palace. How it glittered, white and silver and surrounded by towering pines, as if hewn from pearl and possessed of its own magic. Its spires were so slender it seemed a breath might topple them, and each balcony, railing, and casement was worked in gauzy stonework so light it looked less like masonry and more like airy tongues of frost. Over all of it loomed the legendary Prophetic's Tower, where scholars from every country came to study and debate their findings with the king's chief advisers and seers. Ulla found it hard to believe mortal hands could have made such a place. "Many human nobles spend the warm days here," said Rolf, nodding toward another cluster of carriages. "They think we're from an estate far to the south." When the footman opened their door, Kalle, the eldest of Rolf's brothers, was waiting, mouth full of warnings. "Take your pleasures as you will," he reminded them as they slowly ascended the wide sweep of the palace steps, still not entirely sure of just how their bodies should align in the act, testing the cold marble through their shoes.
"But remember how fragile these creatures are. Spill not their blood. Draw not their notice."
His gaze lingered upon Ulla, too. Through two high, narrow doors they passed, into a grand entry flanked by curving staircases that met in a broad landing above. Again they climbed, muscles trembling at the unfamiliar work of it, clutching the banister, surprised at the weight of their bodies, the drag of their clothes. Finally, they reached the top of the stairs and entered a long audience chamber, teeming with people. There were men and women of every country here, swathed in lace and rich silks, jewels at their cuffs, little gilded heels on their shoes. Ulla marveled at how different they were from the Hidjit, with their broad shoulders and bent backs, their thick-knuckled hands and weather-ravaged faces. These were the soft-perfumed bodies of people who did not work. Silence fell as the Sildroher passed, and Ulla found it hard not to laugh at the thought of Kalle's warning. There was no way their party could avoid drawing notice. Despite their tentative steps, the sea folk moved as no human could, their lithe bodies drifting in a liquid sway, their limbs graceful as seagrass. As they'd been instructed, they made their bows and curtsies to the human king, who greeted the royal brothers warmly. And well he should, for though their clothes might be peculiar and their accents strange, each year the Sildroher brought such treasures as the human king had never seen. Kalle gestured to his servants, who carried forward three chests of pearls. The first were white and luminous as snow, the next the silvery gray of storm clouds, and the third chest of pearls glittered blacker than a moonless night. There were chests of coin, too, jeweled swords, heavy trenchers made of gold. Ula watched the mortal king smile and preen and pour wine into a silver cup, little realizing that this treasure had come from wrecked ships, gifts from dead men, their bones rotting at the bottom of the sea. What did mortals care? Treasure was treasure. But as the eyes of the human court were focused on each new gem and bauble, Ula saw that one young man did not gawk or marvel. He stood behind the king's throne, beside a bearded man who wore the sash and smoky blue sapphire of a seer. The boy's clothes were black, his hair blacker still, and he was looking directly at Ula, the weight of his stare heavy ballast. Ula returned his gaze, expecting him to glance away. He did not, and though she knew it was impossible, she had the strange sensation that she'd met him before. The king clapped his hands. The doors to the feasting hall were thrown open, and the nobles moved forward in order of rank. But as Ula drifted through the doors of the audience hall to the strange smells of human food beyond, she looked back and saw the boy in black still watching. They feasted. They danced. They lifted cups of wine to their lips for the first time. They laughed and stomped their feet as the mortals did, in time with fiddle and drum. The humans clustered around the Sildroher, blood suffusing their warm cheeks, chests rising as if they couldn't quite catch their breath, eyes moist and glittering with desire, and by evening's end Roth had one mortal girl on his knee, another tucked close against him. Ula could not see the pain in Signy's face, but she saw the effort her friend took to hide it.
"You knew why he wanted us here," Ula reminded her, as gently as she could. "Not for love, but for magic, for what they might help Roth accomplish on shore."
Signy shrugged one gleaming shoulder. She had drawn her hair back from her face with two sapphire combs and changed into a corseted blue gown that curled like a wave over her breasts and left her white shoulders bare. How many times had Ula seen Signy's shoulders? Why, now that they were framed by silk, did they seem like something entirely new?
"He's meant to have his fun,"
Signy said with ease that did not ring true.
"You should have some, too,"
said Ula, and took Signy's hand. Drew her back into the dance. Let the heat of human bodies, the brief wild flutter of mortal life, surround them. Later, when the candles burned low, and Ula towed her pinching slippers from her feet, when she'd bound her damp hair in a braid, marveling at the moisture that beaded at the nape of her neck, when the wine fizzed happily in her blood, and the shadowed corners were full of ardent gasps and low laughter, she leaned back against the wall, shoved another body away, and wondered why she did not feel the pull the others did. The Sildroher went to shore to taste human language, to sample the decadence of their world, but also to sample them. It was a means of easing their longing, controlling their temptations. Always the sea folk have been drawn to mortals, to their solid bodies and brief lives, the way they strive and toil and quiver with endeavor. So why did Ula feel no desire? Why could she not be like Signy, swaying slowly, clasped in mortal arms, or Roth, plucking kisses from each eager human mouth? Was she doomed to sit at the edge of the world here, as she had below the waves? It was only then that she saw the black-clad boy crossing the room toward her. The shadows seemed to shift as he passed, pulled along by him like a tide. Ula took in the familiar angles of his face, the slash of his dark brows, and felt fear coil in her stomach. She touched her tongue to her teeth, already imagining the song she would raise to defend herself. Such music would doom her. Sildroher magic was not for mortal eyes. But the thought reassured her nonetheless.
"I remember you,"
he said when at last he reached her. His eyes were gray agate.
"That is impossible," she thought to say, but instead asked, "Who are you?"
"The seer's apprentice."
"And can he really tell the future?"
she asked, her curiosity getting the best of her.
"He can tell the king what he wants to hear, and that's more important than knowing the future."
Ula knew she should say her goodnights, put distance between herself and this odd creature. But she'd had too much wine to heed caution.
"Why do you say you remember me? And why do you watch me like a black-backed gull seeking prey?"
He leaned forward slightly, and Ula could not help drawing back.
"Come to the prophetic's tower tomorrow," he said,
voice cool as glass.
"Come, and I'll tell you all you wish to know."
"To the library?" She could not read.
Only the Sildroher royal family could, trained in the ways of diplomacy and treaties.
"I do not expect you to read,"
he said as he slipped past her without a sound.
"Any more than you expect me to breathe underwater."
Ula slept badly that night. When the sun had set, the cold had crept into her bones, and she shivered beneath the covers. She could not get warm or purge the scent of sweat and tallow and roasting meat from her nose. She couldn't get used to the feeling of the bed beneath her, the sense that her heavy body might sink right through the sheets. Then there was the painful pressure that had pushed at her abdomen until at last she remembered the chamber pot and what she was meant to do with it. When at last she dozed, she dreamed of her parents, of her father's cold eyes and her mother's sorrowful hands tugging at her hair as if, were she only able to pull hard enough, she might change its color. Ula woke early, filled the basin nearly to the brim, and plunged her face into the cold water, letting the silence fill her ears, trying to remember herself. Her few belongings had already been placed in her dressing room, and she quickly checked the contents of her locked trunk, making sure the sickern blade was safely bundled in the folds of her scales. She could not quite settle. Her skin smelled sour, wrapped tight and stiff around her frame. Her stomach growled. She ran her hand over the bed's embroidered coverlet, drew off her slippers, and felt the cool stone floors through the soles of her feet. She plunged her toes into the soft furs that had been laid before a vast hearth. Though the summer air was warm, the palace was all cold rock and high ceilings, and the remnants of a fire smoldered in the grate. She had been too tired to realize it was there the previous night, but now Ula knelt before it, felt the heat radiating from it against her palms, and had to keep herself from reaching for those glowing embers. She had studied the songs and artifacts. She knew the idea of fire. She'd been taught about it, sung the word, but seeing it, so close and so alive, it was like having a little son to keep all for herself. The chamber had tall, pointed windows that looked out over the royal gardens and the forest beyond, and on the table set before them was a gray glass ewer, full of what Ula thought might be roses, heavy-headed things, their smell sweet and strange, their pale, dawn-pink petals slightly darker at the center. She touched her fingers to the place on her neck where her gills had been before the song of transformation, then inhaled deeply, the scent of the flowers filling her nose and lungs, and making her dizzy. She plucked a petal and laid it thoughtfully on her tongue. When she chewed, the taste was disappointingly bitter. She was grateful when a maid arrived bearing a tray of tea and salt fish, followed by servants carrying pails of steaming water. Though Ula had been told about bathing, she'd never been properly dirty before, and she was shocked at the dust that washed from her body in a gritty cloud, the slip of sweet oils that coated her. But nothing was more startling than the sight of her funny little toes curled over the tub's edge, the tender bones of her ankles, the smooth incrustations of her claws, nails. The water felt too slick on her skin, flat and saltless as the rivers she had explored with Signy and Rolf on cloudy afternoons. Once Ula was clean and dry and padded with powder, the maid helped her into a gown and laced her tight, then vanished out the door with a nervous glance over her shoulder. Only then, in the silence of her room, did Ula finally see herself in the mirror that hung above her dressing table. Only then did she realize why she'd drawn so many stares from the Sildroher, and from the humans as well. Away from the blue depths of the sea, the sallow gray-green tinge of her skin was gone, and she glowed burnished bronze, as if she had tucked sunlight beneath her tongue. Her hair was black as it had always been, but here in the bright light of the human world, it shone like polished glass. Her eyes were still dark and strange, but dark like a midnight path that might lead somewhere wonderful. Strange like the sound of a new language. She left her room, the palace silent around her, as servants went quietly about their business, careful not to wake the revelers who had stumbled to their beds only hours before. Ula realized there were mirrors everywhere, as if humans were afraid they might forget what they looked like, and in them she saw her new self reflected, tall and lithe, floating in gray lace like sea foam, the pearls of her bodice gleaming softly, stars through fog. The apprentice was waiting at the base of the tower stairs. Without a word, they began to climb, Ula clinging to the banister as they rose higher, the air thick with dust that glittered in beams of early morning sun. Books had a scent, she realized. As they passed level after level of libraries and laboratories, shelves lining their round walls, packed with brightly bound volumes in tight rows. The books meant nothing to her. The Sildroher had no pen and paper, no parchment survived beneath the waves, and they had no need of it. Their histories and knowledge were held in song. At each level the apprentice named another subject: history, augury, geography, mathematics, alchemy. Ula hoped they'd wind all the way to the top of the tower, where she knew they'd find the famous observatory. But instead, when there were still many floors above to discover, the apprentice led her from the spiral stairs to a dimly lit room set with long tables and tall glass cabinets. They were full of odd objects, a golden hoop spinning continuously on its axis, stuffed birds with scarlet feathers and glossy beaks, a harpoon made of what looked like volcanic glass. One entire shelf was taken up by hourglasses of different sizes and filled with varied colors of sand. Another contained flats of insects pinned to boards. And still another was crowded with many-legged specimens floating in sealed jars of amber fluid. Ula drew in a breath when she glimpsed a sicker knife, wondering who it had belonged to and what possible reason its owner could have for relinquishing it. But she forced herself to move on, conscious of the apprentice's observant gaze. They passed a vast mirror, and Ula saw their shapes reflected in the gloom. The girl in the glass waved. Ula leapt back, and the apprentice laughed. His reflection joined him, though the pitch was not quite the same. "I can hear him," Ula said, clutching the edge of the table. It was as if the boy in the glass was simply another boy in another part of the room, as if the frame were an open doorway. "It's an illusion, nothing more," the apprentice said, and his reflection gave a dismissive wave of his hand.
"A powerful one."
"A useless one. It's a frivolous object. My master's predecessor made it, while attempting to find a way to place a soul in the mirror so that the old king might live forever once his body was gone. All he managed was this."
Ula peered at her reflection, and the girl in the glass smiled. No wonder others shied away from her. There was something sly in the mirror girl's expression, as if her lips might part and show an extra row of teeth.
"It's impressive nonetheless," she managed.
"It's a waste. The reflection has no soul. No animating spirit. All it can do is echo. The new king brings it down for parties, to charm the guests. You'll see, at the ball. They put it in the main hall as a diversion. You can even have a little conversation with yourself."
Ula could not resist such a temptation.
"Hello," she said tentatively. "Hello."
the mirror girl answered.
Who are you? Who are you?
There was that smile again.
Did Ula imagine it?
Or had the girl's inflection changed? Ula sang a soft note, not a spell, just a sound. And the girl opened her mouth, joining Ula in harmony.
Ula couldn't help the delighted laugh that sprang from her, but the mirror girl flushed when she saw the apprentice's bemusement.
It seems I am as easily entertained as the king's party guests, said Ula.
His lips quirked.
We all love novelty.
The apprentice's gaze slid to their reflection, and he squared his shoulders so that he and Ula stood side by side, much the same height, their hair as black and gleaming as deep-water pearls.
Look at that,
he said, and his reflection lifted a brow.
We might almost be blood relations.
He was right, Ula realized.
It was not just the hair or the slender reed build that they shared. There was something in the shape of their faces, the sharp cut of their bones.
She touched her fingers to her scalp as if she could still feel her mother's hands tugging at her braids, hear her doleful song withering their garden, and filling Ula with regret. The apprentice was offering her an answer. An oyster pried open, a jewel upon a plate. She need only reach for it. She said nothing.
Why are you here in Sonderman?
He asked. And his reflection remained quiet, as if waiting to hear the answer, too. Ula ran her thumb over the table. Her reflection blinked rapidly, looking far more flustered than she would have liked.
I came for the cool weather, she said lightly.
You came here to study?
No,
said the apprentice. The gray eyes of his reflection narrowed. His voice was like the cold pull of a glacier.
I came here to hunt.
Beneath the waves, small creatures survived by hiding when a predator was near, and everything in Ula longed to cower, to tuck herself into some scrap of shadow and escape his gaze. But there was nowhere to hide here on land, and the Sildrohar did not shrink from humans. She had a song, and he was only a mortal. Ula turned to the apprentice, made herself meet his gaze without flinching.
Then I wish you good fortune, she said, and easy prey.
He smiled, the same sly, dangerous smile she'd seen on her own face in the glass. Ula had come for answers, but why should she believe this boy knew anything about her? For all she knew, his mysterious words had been nothing but an empty lure. Best to get away quickly. Besides, even in that long-ago time, Ula knew a bad bargain. Maybe this boy held secrets, but whatever knowledge he might possess would not be worth the price. She turned her back on him and forced herself not to run, as she began the long, winding journey down the stairs. Despite the apprentice and his threat, for a time Ula was happy. They all were, in their own ways. Rolf took his pleasures. Signy suffered, but drowned her longing in a tide of human lovers. And Ula let herself be carried away, too. Far from the clutter of ardent hearts, into the wilds of the wood, where the pines made a green cathedral, and the air was thick with the smell of sun-warmed sap. She watched for deer and beaver, stained her lips with berries, marked the sun on its path as it set beneath the horizon, then rose again to color the whole world. At night she feasted with the others, watched Signy hope and Rolf charm, and all his golden brothers hold court. The beauty that had revealed itself in Ula when she came to land earned her gifts of jewels and poetry, posies left outside her door, even a proposal. Nothing could tempt her, and this only strengthened her allure. The steady beat of mortal fascination made her weary. She would sit for hours as the great hall emptied, listening to the human musicians, studying their fingers on the frets of an oud, giving herself over to the thump of the drum, the pull of the bow, until the last note was played. There were legends of instruments enchanted by Sildrohar and gifted to human favorites, finger cymbals that made the dancer more graceful, harps that would play themselves when their strings were wetted with blood, but for Ula there was only music. Some nights, when Signy had taken no lover, she would come to Ula's room and they would wriggle beneath the covers, feet tangled together, chafing each other's hands and laughing themselves warm. Those were the nights when Ula did not dream of her mother or father, of the apprentice's teeth, or the cold blue silence of the deep. But as the days passed, Roth's temper changed, and Ula saw his brothers become watchful and secretive too. They dallied less with mortal girls and spent long hours in the prophetic's tower. Ula knew they were all searching the pages of human books for mortal magic, for a gift they might bring back to their father, the thing that might change their fortunes forever. As Rolf's mood grew darker, Signy became restless and skittish too, endlessly twining her bright hair around her nervous fingers, her teeth worrying her lower lip until it bled in tiny garnet beads. "You must stop," Ula told her beneath the blankets, dabbing the blood away with the sleeve of her nightgown. "Your misery won't fix this for him. He'll find his way. There's still time. When he does, he'll seek you out." "Both of us," said Ula. "But you are the composer," Signy said, pressing her feverish forehead to Ula's. "You are the one he needs." "He needs us both for any song of worth." The tears came and then Signy's voice broke. "When he truly understands your power, he will want you for his bride. He will leave me behind." Ula held her close, wishing she could shake Signy from these thoughts. Neither of them were fit to be a princess, no matter how powerful their song. "I will never leave you. I have no wish to be his bride." Signy's laugh was bitter in the dark. "He's a prince, Ula. He will have what he wants." As if Signy's own small hands had set a secret clock ticking, Rolf approached Ula the next day. It was late afternoon, and a long, languorous meal of cold fowl and chestnuts with citron had been served on the terrace overlooking the gardens. Chilled bottles of yellow cherry wine had been emptied, and now, as the servants cleared the table, humans and Sildroher drowsed in leafy alcoves, or chased one another through the turns of the hedge maze. Ula stood at the terrace's edge, looking down at the gardens, listening to the bees hum. Her mind had already begun to build a song that might transform a corner of the undersea garden she and Signy had raised for the royal family into a maze like this, with a whirling pool at its center. It would be a trick of the eye, of course, a gesture toward human fountains. But she thought fish could be made to swim in a circle if she could simply build a strong enough pattern into the melody.
"I need a gift, like Runstrom's tiger," said Rolf, coming up beside her and leaning on his elbows. "A horse, a great lizard if I could find one."
The tiger was a legendary gift, but it was no simple spell. The creature had to be enchanted to breathe underwater, to endure the cold, and then to obey its master. Runstrom's tiger had survived barely a year beneath the sea, long enough to make a second son a king.
"You'll have to do better than that," she murmured, the sun warm on her shoulders, "or you'll look no better than a cheap imitation."
"Kalle and Edvin have already found their gifts, or so they say. But still I falter. An elixir of strength from the alchemist? A bird that sings beneath the waves?"
Ula huffed out a breath, a human gesture she'd learned to enjoy.
"Why does it matter? Why do you even want to be king?"
"I thought you of all people would understand."
Hungry Ula. Maybe she did. A song had made two lonely girls friends. A prince's favor had made them worthy of notice. What might a crown do for that prince?
"You want to spend your days negotiating with the other sea folk?" she asked. "Your nights in endless ritual?"
She bumped her shoulder against his.
"Rolf, you can barely be counted upon to rise before noon."
"That's what advisors are for."
A king cannot simply rely on advisors.
A king bows to no one, Roth said, his blue eyes trained on something Ula could not see. A king chooses his own path, his own wife.
Ula shifted uneasily, wishing she could be weightless for just a moment, caught in the saltwater arms of the sea. Was Roth making the very offer Signy had feared?
Roth, she began.
But as if sensing her discomfort, Roth continued.
A king chooses his own court, his own singers.
How easily princes played. How easily they spoke of dreams they had no business offering. But Ula could not help the yearning she felt as Roth bent his head as if to whisper endearments.
I would raise you so high, Ula. No one would gossip about your birth or your wayward mother ever again.
Ula flinched. It was one thing to know what others thought, another to hear it spoken.
They will always gossip.
Roth smiled slightly.
Then they will do it far more quietly.
What might a crown do for a prince? What might a king do for a girl like her? Signy's laughter floated up to them from the maze below. She was easy to spot, her hair burning like banked embers, a red banner of war streaming behind her as a mortal boy pursued her down the row. Ula watched her let the boy catch her, spin her around.
"You want to win the throne and impress your father?"
she asked Roth.
"You know I do."
Signy tossed back her head and threw her arms wide, her face framed by curls like living flame.
Ula nodded. Then bring him fire.
As soon as she said it, Ula realized her foolishness, but from then on, the prince could think of nothing else.
He left off chasing human girls entirely, cloistered himself in the prophetic's tower, barely ate or drank.
He will drive himself mad, said Signy as they shivered beneath the covers one night. I doubt he has the focus for it.
Don't be unkind.
I don't mean to be, said Ula, and she thought that it was true.
Could the mirror be a gift for the king instead?
Signy asked. Ula had told her of the strange mirror and the room full of odd objects in the tower.
He might be amused by it.
For a time. Roth only thinks of fire day and night.
Why did you put such a thought in his head?
Because he made me dream of things I cannot have, she thought, but said,
he asked, and I answered,
he should know better than to think it's possible. It was one thing to bring a creature of the land beneath the sea and make it live and breathe for a time. That was powerful magic, yes, but not so radically different from the enchantments that allowed the Sildroher to walk on land, but to toy with the elements. To make a flame burn when it had no fuel to do so, it would require greater magic than the song that had created the Nautilus Hall.
It could not be done.
He must turn his mind to something else.
So I've told him, Signy fretted, but he will not listen.
She tugged gently at Ula's cuff.
Perhaps the king's seer might help, or the seer's apprentice? He's been friendly to you, I've seen it.
Ula shivered. The apprentice had left her in peace since that day in the tower. He seemed to have his own work to attend to, but she was aware of him always, sitting silent at table beside his master, walking the grounds, the spilled ink of his black clothes moving from shadow to shadow.
Talk to him, insisted Signy. Please, Ula.
She took Ula's hands in hers.
For me, won't you at least speak to him? What harm could it do?
Quite a lot, Ula suspected.
Perhaps. Ula!
Perhaps, she said, and rolled over. She did not want to look at Signy anymore. But when her friend took up a dreaming song, low and sweet, Ula could not help but join her. It wove a warm glow around them as it rose and fell. Ula did not know which of them fell asleep first, only that she dreamed she stood in the center of the hedge maze, wearing a mantle of fire,
paralyzed, unable to do anything but burn. When she opened her mouth to cry out, no sound emerged, and in the distance she saw Signy poised on the edge of the terrace, as if to take flight, the flame of her hair hidden by a white bridal veil. The days crept by. Roth grew more frantic. Signy's gaze grew more accusatory. Ula knew only fear was keeping her from the apprentice. She had not mistaken Roth's message. If the flame could be mastered and Roth made king, he would choose Ula as his court singer. She had to at least try to speak to the apprentice. He might be dangerous, but abandoning even a small chance to make her dream real seemed more dangerous still. Ula found him in a reading room at the bottom of the prophetic's tower, packing books into a simple satchel. One was bound in leather, its pages loose and covered in a frenzied scrawl that differed from the orderly pattern she'd seen in other books, though it was equally meaningless to her. In one corner she spied what looked like the antlers of a stag. The apprentice snapped the satchel closed.
"You're leaving?"
She could not keep the surprise or relief from her voice as she hovered in the doorway. There was only so much courage she would demand of herself.
"I can never stay in any one place too long."
She wondered why. Had he committed some crime?
"You will miss the ball," she noted.
A bare smile touched his lips.
"I do not care for dancing."
But Ula had not risked this visit for the sake of idle conversation. She flexed her toes in her slippers. There was nothing for it but to ask.
I seek a flame that might burn beneath the sea."
The apprentice's gray eyes skewered her like a pin through a moth's body.
"And what possible use could such a thing have?"
"A frivolity," Ula said, "like the mirror. A trifle for a king."
"Ah," mused the apprentice, "but which king?"
Ula said nothing. The apprentice tightened the clasps on his satchel.
"Come," he said, "I will give you two answers."
"Two?" she said as she followed him up the spiral stairs.
"One to the question you asked, and one to the question you should have asked."
"What question is that?" She realized he was leading her back to the room of strange objects.
"Why you are not like the others."
Ula felt the cold settle in her bones, the night rushing in vaster than the sea. Still she followed. When the apprentice opened the door of the glass cabinet beside the trick mirror, she thought he would reach for the sickern knife. Instead, he held up a bell that she hadn't even noticed, the size of an apple and tarnished from neglect. As he lifted it, the clapper struck, a high silvery sound, and Ula released a cry, clutching at her chest. Her muscles seized. It felt as if a fist had squeezed itself tight around her heart.
"I remember you," he said, watching her,
the same words he'd spoken when he'd approached her at the first night's feast.
"That can't be,"
she gasped, breathless from the pain, the ache receding only as the sound of the bell faded.
"Do you know why your voice is so strong?"
the apprentice asked.
"Because you were born on land. Because you took your first breath above the surface and bawled your first infant cry here. Then, my mother, our mother, took up the bell your father had given her, the bell he'd placed in her hand when he realized she carried a child. She went down to the shore, and knelt at the waters, and held the bell beneath the waves. She rang it once, twice, and a few moments later your father emerged in the shallows, his silver tail like a sickle moon behind him, and took you away."
She shook her head.
"It cannot be."
"Look into the mirror," he commanded, "and try to deny it."
Ula thought of her mother's long fingers combing through her hair tentatively, then grudgingly, as if she could not quite bear to touch her. She thought of her father who had raged and warned of the temptations of the shore.
"It must not be."
"I remember you," he repeated. You are born with a tail. Every summer I've come here to study and watch the sea folk, wondering if you might return.
No, said Ula.
No, the Sildroher cannot breed with humans. I cannot have a mortal mother.
He gave a slight shrug. Not entirely mortal. The people of this country would call her Druja, witch. They would call me one, too. They play at magic, read the stars, throw bones. But it's best not to show them real power. Your people know this well.
Impossible, insisted a shrill, frightened voice inside her. Impossible.
But another voice, a voice sly with knowing, whispered,
You have never been like the others, and you never will be. Her black hair, her black eyes, the strength of her song. It cannot be true. But if it was true, then she and this boy shared a mother. Had Ula's father known the girl he'd laid down with was a witch? That there might be a price for his dalliance, one he would be forced to look upon every day? And what of Ula's Sildroher mother? Had she been able to bear no child of her own? Was that why she had made a cradle for some unnatural thing, fed her, tried to love her?
She does love me,
that voice again, wheedling now, feeble.
She does.
Ula felt the hurt inside her winnow to a hard point. And did your witch mother care at all for the child she abandoned to the sea? But the apprentice did not look troubled by her harsh words.
She isn't one for sentiment.
Where is she?
Ula asked. A mother should be here to greet her daughter, to explain herself, to make amends.
Far to the south, traveling with the Suli. I'll meet with her before the weather turns. Come with me. Ask her your questions. If you think the answers will bring you comfort.
Ula shook her head again, as if such a gesture might erase this knowledge. Her limbs had gone weak. She grasped the lip of the table, tried to stay standing. But it was as if, with the ringing of that bell, her legs had forgotten what they were meant to do. Ula slid to the floor and watched the girl in the glass do the same.
You claimed you were hunting,
she said, a flimsy kind of protest.
They say the sea whip roams these waters. I want to see the ice dragon for myself. Knowledge. Magic. A chance to forge the world anew. I came seeking all those things. I came seeking you.
The apprentice knelt beside her.
Come with me, he said. You needn't return with them. You needn't belong to them.
Ula could taste the salt of her tears on her lips. It reminded her of the sea. Was she crying, then? What a human thing to do. She could feel herself splitting, dissolving, as if the apprentice's words had been a spell. It was like the cut of the sicker knife, being torn apart all over again, knowing that she would never be wholly one thing or another, that the sea would always be strange upon her, that she would always carry the taint of land. Nothing could transform her. Nothing could make her right. If the Sildroher ever learned what she was, that the rumors were not just rumors, but true, she would be banished, maybe killed. Unless she was too powerful to abandon. If Roth became king. If Ula found a way to give him what he wanted. He could protect her. She could make herself unassailable, indispensable. There was still time.
The flame, she said. Tell me how it's done.
He sighed and shook his head, then rose.
You know very well what it requires. You are creating a contradiction. A flame must be made and remade from moment to moment if it is to burn beneath the water.
Transformation. Creation. This would be no mere illusion.
Blood magic, she whispered.
He nodded.
But the blood of the sea folk will not be enough.
At this, Ula's heart gave a frightened hitch. There were few rules the Sildroher were bound by on land. They might trifle with the humans, break their hearts, steal their secrets or their treasures,
but they could not take a mortal life. Remember how fragile these creatures are. Spill not their blood. The sea folk had too much power over the people of the shore as it was.
Human blood?
Even speaking the words felt like a transgression.
Not just blood.
Her brother bent and whispered the requirements of the spell into the shell of Ula's ear.
Ula shoved him away and scrambled to her feet, stomach roiling, wishing she could unhear the words he'd just uttered.
"Then it cannot be done," she said.
She was lost. Roth was lost. It was that simple, that final. She brushed the tears from her eyes and smoothed her skirts, wishing they were scales.
"The prince will not be happy."
Her brother laughed. He touched his finger to the silver bell that still sat on the table.
"We were not made to please princes."
"You were born on land. You took your first breath above the surface and bawled your first infant cry here." And she'd been crying out since. She did not want the apprentice's knowledge, not of her birth, not of the ways of blood magic. She did not want this tower with its rotting books and pillaged treasures. She turned and fled toward the stairs. Then the bell tolled, sweet and silver, the sound a hook that lodged in her heart. Her muscles contracted, and she felt herself turning as the bell drew her back, just as it had once compelled her father. Ula seized the door jamb, forced her muscles to still, refusing to let her traitorous legs carry her back. She looked over her shoulder. The apprentice wore the faintest smile as he placed the bell back in the cabinet, silencing its terrible ring. Ula felt her muscles ease, her pain abate. The apprentice closed the glass door.
"I must go," he said. "I have my own war ahead, a long one. I am not quite mortal either, and I have many lives to live. Consider my offer," he said quietly. "There is no magic that can make them love you."
There was, but she could not accomplish it. Ula launched herself out of the room and down the stairs. She lost her footing, stumbled forward, grasped the banister, righted herself, and plunged downward once more. She needed the sea. She needed Signy, but Signy was not in her room nor in the gardens. At last she found her in the music gallery, head resting on a mortal girl's shoulder as they listened to a boy play a silver harp. When she saw Ula, she leapt to her feet.
"What is wrong?" she asked, taking Ula's hands and pulling her onto the stone balcony. "What has happened?"
Far below, the waves crashed. The salt breeze lifted Ula's hair and she breathed deep.
"Ula, please,"
Signy said, distraught. She tugged Ula down beside her onto a marble bench. Its base was carved to look like leaping dolphins.
"Why these tears?"
But now that she was here, now that Signy's arm was around her, what could Ula say? If Signy shrank from her, showed even the slightest sign of revulsion, Ula knew she couldn't bear it. She would be undone.
"Signy,"
she attempted, eyes on the far blue plain of the ocean.
What if the stories about me were true? What if I was not Sildroher, but mortal too?
Thruja, witch.
Signy expelled a disbelieving laugh.
"Don't be silly, Ula. No one ever really believed that. They were just children being cruel."
"Will you not answer?"
"Oh, Ula,"
Signy chided, drawing Ula's head onto her lap.
"Where is this nonsense coming from? Why this misery?"
"A dream," she murmured. "A bad dream."
"Is that all?"
Signy began to hum a calming song, one that wove between the stray notes that drifted out to them from the harp.
"Will you not answer?"
Ula whispered again. Signy ran a gentle hand over the silk of Ula's hair.
"I wouldn't care if you were part human or part frog. You would still be my fierce Ula. You always will be."
They sat that way a long while as the harpist played, and Ula wept, and the wind blew in cold over the unchanging sea.
Ula did not join Signy at the afternoon meal. Instead, she walked down to the cliffs, then on into the woods, where the pines caught the breeze off the water and seemed to whisper, "Hush, hush." Her dress was rumpled, her slippers grass-stained, and she was sure of nothing anymore. She could travel with the apprentice, her brother. She could meet her true mother, but it would mean never returning to the sea. 3 months they were allowed on shore, and no more. The longer the Sildroher stayed on land, the greater chance they had of revealing their power or forming attachments that could not be easily broken, so the enchantments binding their tails and gills would last only that long. Perhaps the rules did not apply to Ula, since she was not quite Sildroher, but there was no way to be sure. And would she ever be truly safe on land? Below the waves she might be odd or even unwanted, but her gifts at least were understood. The apprentice himself had said that mortals did not like to see real power, and he had little idea of what her song could do. She sensed that perhaps it was best that he didn't know. Ula thought of the spell's requirements and shuddered. She could not give Roth and Signy what they wanted. No one could. And yet when she found Roth in the gardens and explained what the apprentice had told her, he did not put his face in his hands and admit defeat. Instead, he leapt to his feet and paced back and forth, crushing green leaves beneath his boot soles. It could be done! Ula lowered herself to the grass in the shade of the alder tree.
No, it could not.
There are prisoners in the palace dungeons, murderers who will face the gallows anyway. We'd be doing no one any harm.
That was a lie she would not indulge in.
No. You needn't sully your hands, Roth pleaded,
going to his knees like a supplicant.
All you need accomplish is the spell.
As if that was some small thing.
It cannot be, Roth.
He placed his hands on her shoulders.
I have been a friend to you, haven't I, Ula? Don't you care for me at all?
Enough to keep you from this wickedness.
Think of what our lives could be. Think of what you might accomplish. We could build a new palace, a new concert hall. I would make you a court singer. You could have your own choir.
The dream she'd held close to her heart for so long. There was no place for her on land or on sea, but Roth was offering her the chance to make one, a chance to forge the world anew. With a choir at her command, she would have her own army, and who would dare challenge her then? The want in her was an animal, scratching at her resolve, fretting its claws and saying, "Why not? Why not?" Safety, respect, companionship, a chance at greatness. What feats might she accomplish? What new music might she make? What future might she lay claim to if she would only take the risk, pay the bloody price? No, she said, finding the anchor's chain within her. She had to keep steady.
I will not make this bargain.
Roth's brow lowered. Weeks in the sun had turned his skin gold, his hair white. He looked like a petulant dandelion, gathering breath to throw a tantrum.
Tell me what you want, Ula. Tell me, and I will give it to you.
She closed her eyes. She had never felt so weary.
I want to go home, Roth. I want the quiet and the weight of the water. I want you to give this up and stop worrying Signy sick.
There was a long silence. When at last Ula looked at Roth, he had rocked back on his heels and was watching her, his head cocked slightly to the side.
I could make Signy my queen, he said.
In that moment, Ula wished that she and Signy had chosen a humbler song when they had first performed for Roth, that they'd never raised the royal gardens or drawn his notice, or come to this place. Cunning Roth. She should have known he would not be so easy to refuse. Had he always known the truth of Signy's heart? Had he enjoyed the steady light of her longing? Cultivated it?
Do you love her at all? Ula asked.
Roth shrugged and stood, brushing grass from his breeches. The sun behind him set his bright hair aglow.
"I love you both," he said easily. "But I would break her heart and yours to take my brother's crown."
"I will not do it," Ula vowed, watching Roth stride across the garden.